All right, it is that time. We have Alex here, Marino is here, Aiden is here. Here comes Caden. Hit the door, please. Just don't hit anybody in the face. See, what did I just say to you?
That's why I did it nice.
Wow. Because you can kiss somebody else, but you don't want to kiss the door. That's for sure. Actually, I should say you might want to kiss somebody else. You never know. All right. So, we left off dealing with the fact that in the wake of Luther, basically questioning the corruption of the church, the infallibility of the Pope, the claim that the church cannot forgive you, that the only way to get to heaven is to have faith. He had other men that jumped into the soiree, if you will. And they started creating essentially what would become other religions. You had that lawyer, Calvin, who created a legalist system of combining church and state. You had Zwingli, who sought to purge the churches in Switzerland, to reform them. And then you had a king who decided he wanted to create a church so he could basically take control of it and use it as a tool to further his policies. Obviously, he wanted to benefit economically, because by taking England out of the Catholic Church, right off the bat, that means one-third of your revenue was staying in your country. And then you can seize the church lands, and you can sell them or give them to your buddies. And of course, the whole government, for the most part, supported this because everyone was getting paid. As far as the theology, as we said, you know, he passed his six articles, and it was just basically all the rules of the Catholic Church except eliminate Pope, insert King. And what was the biggest use of this vehicle? Keep going until you get a son. And he achieved that. But here's the problem. He made the church for him. Does anybody live forever? So this means what he created obviously would change when he was gone. So unlike the Lutheran church, Luther made his Bible, Luther made his theology, but he trained priests. So when he died, his church continued in the hands of other men. Zwingli would die on the battlefield, as we're going to see. But again, he reformed the churches. Although doing so, he also paved the way for Calvinism. Calvin, he just made the rules, the template. And other people followed. But in England, no, it's about the king. King. So this meant the nature of the Church of England would change with the rise and fall of every subsequent monarch. Just like, I'll give you the best analogy I can give you. If you live in an old house, a house that's been around for many years, and your mom and dad bought it from somebody. Who bought it from somebody? Who bought it from somebody? Every single owner of your house changed things. From painting the walls, to curtains, wallpaper, rugs, outside features. The core of the house is there, but every new owner implanted their vision upon it. And that's what would happen in England. So the result was constant instability. Instability that would last for decades. Are we really Catholic, or are we supposed to do the Protestant stuff? Because each one of the king's successors brought with them their own attitudes. And it's going to culminate in a descendant, as we're going to see, actually getting his head cut off. Now, who's going to succeed the king? Well, here's the thing. Because Henry was the king, we know he divorced Catherine and basically disinherited Mary, his first daughter. And then Anne Boleyn, labeled her a traitor, cut off her head. He also disinherited Elizabeth. But then when he got married to Jane Seymour, Jane encouraged Henry to bring his girls back. To basically acknowledge the fact that both girls don't have their moms anymore. But they are his children. So when Jane was alive, he actually brought the daughters back into the fold. In a sense, he re-inherited them. And he could do that because he was king. And that's reflected in one of the last major pieces of legislation he passed before his death. It is the Act of Succession. He put into law who he wants to follow him. And interestingly enough, it included all of his kids. Even his daughters. Of course, his son would succeed him. But if something happened to Edward and he died heirless, the throne would pass to his firstborn daughter, making it the first instant in European history where a king puts into law that a daughter would legally succeed him and be sovereign. Now, FYI, there were other daughters who became queens in European history. But the power, the sovereignty, would always go to their husbands. Never the woman. But Henry didn't care. Why? Because he's the head of church and state. If something would happen to Mary and she were to die without an heir, well, then the throne would pass to Elizabeth. But what happens if Elizabeth dies without an heir? Because remember, Henry's only focus is dynasty. Well, he put into law that the descendants of his sister Mary, who had gone to Scotland and had married the King of Scotland, James the Fourth, I think. Was either James the Third or James the Fourth, doesn't matter. But she's still alive, and so if none of his kids produce offspring, well, it's going to go to the descendants, at least, of my sister, so it stays in the family. Sovereignty to a woman, sovereignty to a woman, sovereignty through a woman. Now, does this make Henry VIII a feminist? Hell no! Henry didn't care that this is going to go to a woman. Henry was only interested in that it stayed in the family. So if it went to a woman, doesn't matter, it's still in the family. Dynasty before all. Questions? So what happened in 1547 when Henry VIII died and he was succeeded by his son, Edward? Well, when Edward came to the throne, he was only 9 years old, which meant he did not rule in his name. It was decided that his uncle, I think John Seymour, I think was his name, would basically serve as regent. In other words, he's going to run the kingdom in the name of his nephew until his nephew comes of age. The interesting thing, though, was that John Seymour would bring in a whole bunch of advisors to the king who were Protestant. They had read the writings of Luther. They had read the writings of Calvin, and they wanted to take the Church of England and Protestantize it. But to Protestantize it, that meant you had to purge the Church of the Catholic remnants. So, all new laws started being passed. Priests could no longer wear the vestiges of the Catholic Church. Masses were no longer be in Latin. They would be in England. Prayer books would be printed only in English. And, most shocking, priest celibacy was ended. Priests could get married if they wanted to. Now, what's the big deal? Well, if you have all the laws that say you are supposed to do something, and I'm not using that word lightly, all of the decrees that structured the Church of England came from law. All of them endorsed or written by Henry. So, for all sakes and purposes, England is still kind of Catholic in tradition, in readings, and all the rest. And then suddenly the whole thing is flipped upside down. Well, the people of England didn't know what to do. Because what happens if you like the church the way it was? Now suddenly you got to go to this newfangled church? What happens if you don't like that church? Well, too bad. Tough titties. It's the law. So, those who resisted began finding themselves being arrested, being put on trial, charged with violating the laws of the land. And yes, in some instances, even executed. Chaos soon resulted. Scotland, which technically was a domain of England, they had gone really full-blown Protestantism, called Presbyterianism. The whole country began resisting all of the laws that were coming from London. And all throughout Scotland, they began rising up, taking up arms, organizing. And all of this disruption and resistance would actually trigger a depression in England. You know, think about all the wacky stuff activists do in our country. You think they invented these ideas of attacking their political opponents? No, human beings have been doing this for all times. So, if you were a Catholic and you wanted the rules to stay Catholic, you didn't give to the church anymore. You didn't go to Mass. You didn't go to work. You know, you began protesting, resisting. And things began to spiral out of control. But, as the pendulum keeps going this way and this way and this way, fate stepped in. Because in 1553, at the age of 15, suddenly the king dies of tuberculosis. And this set off panic. Because now all of the people who had been in government had been Protestant, were trying to force England to become a Protestant country. But they knew something about, under the law, who would be next. Mary. Mary was a Catholic. So, what did they attempt to do? Well, they attempted to actually violate the laws of the land, to block the act of succession. Just before Edward died, within the months before, the young king and the council would gather, and they would declare who Edward would name as his legal heir. they decided to select Jane Grey. Now, who was Lady Jane Grey? Well, she was the great-granddaughter of Mary, Henry's sister. So essentially what this group conspires to do is to skip Mary, who technically is next, skip Elizabeth, who is after Mary, and go right to the end. Why? Because she was a Protestant. When the king died, the palace declared her as queen. She was crowned, but she never had a coronation ceremony. Did anyone watch when Charles became king in England? What had to happen in order for Charles to fully become king?
A coronation? Isn't it like you pass down, like, you have to like have a whole service and pass it down the crown?
Yeah, you have to have a whole ceremony that's in the church. And by the way, the only way you can have a coronation is if Parliament approves it. That's the reason why when Queen Elizabeth II died, it was like 5 months before Charles was actually crowned. Because Parliament makes the decision. Well, Parliament gets wind of this, and they sit back and say, whoa, wait a minute. The law says Edward, Mary, Elizabeth, then descendants of Mary. If we do this, we're violating the law. Plus, as I mentioned before, the people of England loved Mary's mother, Catherine. They were disgusted at what Henry did to her. Well, that love was reflected in Mary. So Parliament basically surmised that if we do this, there's going to be a revolution. There's going to be an uprising. So Parliament refused to authorize a coronation. She technically was queen for 9 days, after which she would be arrested, put on trial, found guilty of treason, and beheaded just outside the walls of the Tower of London. With Edward dead and Jane Grey eliminated, in comes Mary Tudor, crowned Queen Mary I of England. Now, in many ways, Mary was like her father. Strong-willed, iron-fisted, and determined to do what she thought was best for England. But she understood the lessons of her father, as abusive as he was to her. Dynasty. Dynasty overall. She knew, being a Catholic, that if she died without an heir, the throne would go to Elizabeth. Now, no one at the time really knew what Elizabeth's religion was. She never really talked politics, because Elizabeth had to be careful. She was not as popular as Mary was. So if she came out and suddenly said she was a Catholic when her stepbrother was king, she could have suffered. So she didn't say anything. And then when Mary became queen, if she said anything, maybe she was a Protestant, she could get in trouble. So Elizabeth didn't say anything, so Mary did not know. So Mary didn't want to take the risk of allowing for another potential Protestant to succeed her. So what does she decide to do? She goes out and she gets married. Because guess what a woman cannot do all by herself? Produce heirs. And she selects her cousin, King Philip II of Spain. The problem was, at this time, Mary was 37. And as I said last class, ladies, tick, 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 tick. Biological clock is ticking. So, even though she got married, even though they did consummate the marriage, even though Philip actually stayed in England for a couple of months, and they did it probably many times, there would be a point when Philip had to go back to Spain. He was the king of Spain, after all. He couldn't stay in England. And she wasn't going to go with him, because she was the queen in England. So while they had a chance, guess what they never did successfully. Now, she did have a false pregnancy in her first year on the throne, which would, of course, would become a national matter. By the way, for you guys that don't know anything about women's biology, women being overtly emotional beings, they have much greater control over men of their bodies. And there are women who have basically convinced themselves, because they wanted it so much that they were pregnant, that they began showing all of the signs of a pregnancy. Their stomach begins to grow. They believe, they feel, you know, kicking. The other telltale signs, you know, they can't hold food down. You know, they feel their body's heat temperature, you know, constantly shifting back and forth. They have weird cravings. You know how many times I had to go to the grocery store at like 1 o'clock in the morning because my wife woke up and said, "I want this." It happens. It's nature. Well, she was absolutely convinced that she was. Unfortunately, after 4 months, the signs stopped. Her stomach stopped swelling. And her period came back. No air. So, because she had no air, Mary would spend her reign doing all that she could to essentially expunge all of the Protestantism that had creeped in during Edward's reign. She contacted the Pope and pledged allegiance to the Catholic Church. She ordered that the alms be collected again, and the annual tithing, the donations, start going to Rome. She ordered the restoration of the Latin Mass. She declared any priests who had got married, declare their marriages void. And she began going after Protestants who resisted, earning her, in her lifetime, the nickname of Bloody Mary. Thousands of suspected Protestants would be arrested, put on trial, executed, including nearly 300 women who would be burned at the stake. Hundreds of nobles would be exiled. Their lands would be seized. They would be attainted, that tool that Henry used. Why? She enforced her will. She was going to restore the church, bring England back as it had been at the beginning of Henry's reign. She also got England involved in wars.
Even though England had always been an enemy of France, she would actually allow English soldiers, English ships, English money to support her husband and in his war against the French. And FYI, it would be during this conflict that France would seize the last little bit of territory that England held, going back to the Hundred Years' War, the Port of Calais. But ironically, the same problems that plagued Edward's reign rose up again. The depression that had started at Edward's reign only expanded. Catastrophic. They don't have exact numbers because they didn't keep records like they do today, but it's estimated that the English economy plunged about 60%. It got so bad, inflation was so high, England had to cancel their whole currency and issue a new method of payment. They moved from the livre, which was a French currency, to the pound. And of course, who got blamed for the crisis? Mary. Even though she came in super popular, soon people wanted her gone. But of course, you can't unelect a queen. But then fate stepped in. In 1558, she would die suddenly. Apparently, she had been suffering from ovarian cancer, going back to her false pregnancy. So now the queen is dead. She did not produce an heir. She caused chaos and violence and destruction. Where are we going to go? Well, England got lucky. Because when Elizabeth took the throne, she, who had always been in the background, watching, paying attention, she saw the abuses of her father. She saw the stupidity and the incompetence of her brother's reign. She saw the outright violence and tyranny of her sister's reign. But she was still head of both church and state. So she decided to basically put the religious question to bed. She would complete the Reformation. Through laws. Less than a year into her reign, Parliament would pass the Reformation Bill. This was a compromise bill. For example, this law defined communion as the physical connection with Jesus. Transubstantiation. The priest says the words, the wafer and the wine become the flesh and the blood of Christ. There's something for the Catholics. But, she said, priests don't have to wear the Catholic robes and tunics. The priest can wear whatever outfit they want. There's something from the Protestants. There'd be so many other pieces, but everything else throughout the bill was that. We'll give a little bit to the Catholics. We'll give a little bit to the Protestants. Compromise. And by the way, no one was to question, because Parliament passed another act of supremacy, declaring her still to be the head of the church. Because, by the way, Mary repealed it. Mary repealed the act of secession because she could not be the head of the church, because the head of the church in the Catholic world is the Pope. Well, they brought it back. So now if you have issues with these religious rules, you could potentially go against the laws of the state. But what happens if you disagree? Well, they also added the act of uniformity, which would remove harsh punishments against people because of their faith. So if you wanted to be a Protestant, you could be a Protestant and the government was going to come after you. Or if you wanted to be a Catholic, you could still be a Catholic. The government's not coming after you. Why? Because it's here. Elizabeth believed that all were her subjects. You want to be a Catholic? Fine. You want to be a Protestant? Fine. She is your queen. And then the last aspect was the prayer book that was passed in 1563 and the theology which was contained in the 39 Articles. They were printed both in English and in Latin. Your choice, which one do you want to read? And throughout all of it, it avoided fanaticism. There was some Catholic stuff in there. There was some Protestant stuff in there. But they intentionally made doctrine vague. So that way, if you didn't quite believe something, you couldn't be branded a heretic. It was less about, well, the church says you must do this because, or you're going to the hell, to, what do you believe? Do what you think is right. It was a moderate church that intentionally did not have the extremes. And ironically, because of Elizabeth, because of the way she did this, she ruled for all, England would be the only major European country that would not suffer a catastrophic religious war. And we're going to talk about those. We might start them today, not quite sure. But when we get through all the big ones, particularly the 30 Years' War, and as we're going to see, 30% of the population of Germany was dead because of which church they went to. The fact that Elizabeth was able to figure this out, even though she was a woman, and set everyone at peace to avoid bloodshed, is just extraordinary. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why today, 400 plus years after she died, Elizabeth I is still regarded as one of the best monarchs in English history. Questions? Because at the end of the day, it's about nationalism. It's not about faith. All right. So we got Lutheranism starting in Germany. We got Calvinism starting in Switzerland and then spreading throughout the world. You got now Anglicanism, which is just a compromise. It appears that the universality of the Catholic Church is gone. It appears that the Catholic Church is going to die to be filed in the dustbin of history. But interestingly enough, as we know, the Catholic Church is still here. How? Well, the Catholic Church would also launch a series of reforms, root word of reformation. But the whole purpose of the Catholic reforms was to counter the initial protests. At the same time Europe was being divided, the mid-16th century, the Catholic Church would experience a period of rejuvenation. But this rejuvenation was motivated by the same causes that sparked the Protestant Reformation. Essentially, it began with an acknowledgement, yeah, the church is not in a good place. Alexander VI, Leo X, real corrupt dudes. The schism, the Babylonian captivity, that's not good. Popes getting involved in politics, leading men on the battlefield, waging war, imposing taxes, that's not good. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that the heir to St. Peter should be a war leader, a dictator. But here's the problem. And by the way, you will experience this in your life many times if you have not already. You get yourself into a problem, but you don't know how to solve it. Because there are multiple avenues in which you can engage in and act. But none of the potential actions are perfect. And they all could create more headaches down the road. So, one of the common mistakes that I know young people engage in, although none of you are stupid enough to do this, is you go out and get a credit card. Because you don't actually have a job. You don't really make much money. But you want that credit card so you can go to Starbucks 4 times a day and get those $12 drinks. Those wacky fruity latte things. And you charge it and 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 charge it. And holy crap, you don't realize that you're paying 25% interest on every single transaction if you don't pay it off. But the problem is you build up such a debt, you can't afford to pay it off in one fell swoop. So you start paying minimum payments, which doesn't even cover the interest alone. So the debt keeps going and going and going and going. And then what do you do? Oh my God, I'm freaking out. I'm begging to mom and dad, can you bail me out? And they say, screw you, dummy. You put yourself into this hole, figure it out. So then what do? You go get another credit card. Because that other credit card promises free balance transfers and 0% interest for 6 months. Oh, I can take that debt and I can move it over there. And then I can start using this card again. Oh! By the way, I told you I'm a lawyer. I do real estate closings. People primarily like refinance their mortgages. And you know what I see more often than not, even with adults? They're doing not only mortgage debt, but they're putting themselves more in debt because they're doing debt consolidation. So in fact, I got an appointment today after I'm done with class. Woman's refinancing her house, and what is she bundling it into it? Like 12 credit cards. Is she actually paying off the debt? No. But she now has to pay the debt over 30 years. And why is she doing this? Well, she probably can't afford all the debt that she built up. So you know the best advice I can give you? And this is advice I gave to my kids, and my kids figured it out real quick. Yeah, you don't have the money, don't do it. You don't need to go get that super duper wacky latte crap from Starbucks. Tastes like shit anyways. Go to the, like, Aldi and get like the $3 bags of coffee. And you can use that and you can have your whatever drink. You get those little machines. You can go buy one and you can make those at home for a fraction of the cost. But what happens if you don't have money to eat the coffee machine? See? Every single possibility leads to other problems. So this same was true with the Catholic Counter-Reformation. They knew what Luther was saying was true. But they didn't know what to do about it. Why? Well, because people have opinions. There was nobody that had the perfect solution, but everyone was able to chime in. And the problem was, is in the Catholic Church, there was a diversity of opinions. And nobody offered a perfect solution. Take, for example, what Erasmus did. Erasmus is the impetus. The guy who gave Luther the grounds to stand on. Textus Receptus. He didn't want to destroy the Catholic Church. He was just an intellectual nerd that engaged in academic work and discovered there could be potential problems and wanted to have a conversation. What should we do about it? He never left the Catholic Church. He stayed a Catholic his whole life. But again, you want proof that the church is corrupt? Look at the way the Vulgate interprets the original New Testament. Erasmus is in the ideological middle. On the left side, to use American politics, the left, the center, the right. On the left would be an interesting figure, Sir Thomas More of England. More was Henry VIII's tutor. It was More who made Henry VIII an intellectual. In 1516, Thomas More wrote a book addressing a possible solution to religious division. And it's a book called Utopia. FYI, what does Utopia mean? What does it actually mean? Does anybody know? Utopia is a Greek word. How is it defined nowadays?
Perfect society.
Perfect society. Well, guess what the word actually means from its Greek origins? And I'll make you think about it. Where is there perfection on earth?
On earth.
Nowhere. Utopia actually means no place. Because what place is perfect? By the way, if any of you ever get your hands on Utopia, it's actually one of the few books that's 500 years old that was written so well, it's easy to understand. Well, in this book, Sir Thomas More tells the tale about a ship captain that is out sailing during the Age of Exploration, and he crashes on an island. The island, coincidentally, was called Utopia. And on the island, you had somebody from the modern world at the time, with the attitudes they had in the day, and he comes in contact with this weird dystopian society where everyone believes the exact same thing. There's no deviation in thought, no deviation in belief. But as the ship captain starts talking to these people, it's soon realized by both parties that the captain's view of the world and belief system is exactly the exact opposite of what all the people on the island believe, and vice versa. Do the islanders burn him at the stake for heresy? Does he go out to his ship and get guns and try to kill all the people on the island? No, you know what they ended up doing? They ended up having a conversation. They talked about what they had in different, what the difference is. And they tried to see if they could find common ground. And if they couldn't find common ground, they just agreed to disagree without being disagreeable. In other words, they acted like adults. So in this book, More is basically telling Europe, look, just because someone reads the Bible a little differently than you, it doesn't mean they're the Antichrist. They just have a different opinion. So we should be tolerant. Why? Well, where in the Bible does it say that God wants everyone to think the exact same thing? Where in the Bible does it say God wants everyone to worship Him the exact same way? So let's have rational discussions. Let's see if we can find areas where we agree together. Compromise. And if not, you be you, dude. And I'll be me. There were many people in the church in the 1510s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s that had that attitude. But the problem was is there was an equal amount that were on the exact other side. The more conservative, the extreme right, if you will. And the best example of this as I can give you is Cardinal Jimenez. Cardinal Jimenez was the Grand Inquisitor of Spain. Do you know anything about the Inquisition? And I'm not talking about the Monty Python skit where nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, because they're not going to throw you in the comfy chair and poke you with the soft cushion. Cardinal Jimenez was entrusted by Ferdinand and Isabella to complete the Reconquista of Spain. The Reconquista would purge Spain of its Jewish and Muslim population. And it would impose a very strict religious orthodoxy on all people in the empire. And how did they do it? Well, Cardinal Jimenez disciplined the clergy. If a priest did not impose the Inquisition or the Reconquista, they would be brutalized. They would be brought before the Inquisition. He also imposed required biblical teachings. So the church told the people what part of the Bible they had to know. But the Bible had to be taught by the priests. Because you can't be trusted to read the Bible for yourself. You're too stupid. And he instilled a sense of devotion in the priesthood that borderlined on fanaticism. So to bring things together, to make connections, why do you think when the Spanish went to the New World, they brought with them the priests from Spain? Because the priests from Spain did the Reconquista on the Aztecs and the Incas and all the islanders. And that's the reason why Central and South America and the Caribbean, those people down there were all Catholics and speak Spanish. Because they purged and destroyed. That was Cardinal Jimenez's belief. So, you, if you were suspected of having heretical thought, the church would come and seize you, and you would be dragged to one of their centers of inquisition, usually in a basement or a dungeon. You would then basically be put on trial, but it really wasn't a trial because you were not allowed to have a lawyer. There was no due process of law. You were basically accused. You had two choices once you were accused. Confess, in which the church would forgive you, or deny. Well, if you denied heresy, you were then turned over to the inquisitors, who enacted torture. The rack. Do you know what the rack is? The rack is the table where they would lay you down and they'd tie your ankles and your wrists to rope. And on one side there was a crank. And they would ask you to confess your sins. And you would say, I did not do anything wrong. Click. One little turn. Latch it into place. And the ropes get tighter. Confess. I did nothing wrong. Click. Pretty soon you would stretch as far as you can go. And then guess what happens? Soon all the tendons and the cartilage begin ripping as your shoulders and your hips get dislocated. Confess, confess, confess. Eventually you would be broken. And even if you did confess at that point, your body's broken. You can't heal from those types of wounds. And they did other things. You know what my favorite one was? It was called the mule. It was like a sawhorse, except instead of having a flat board, it was a triangular carved tree. You would then be raised up above by ropes. You would be lowered down. Really sharp edge. There would also be ropes down on your ankles. And weights would be added. How long do you think you could sit there? And by the way, if you appear to be comfortable, they would add more weights. And they would add more weights. And they would add more weights. Down here, very delicate bones that would break. And once they broke, good luck walking. Good luck trying to have sex. Good luck going to the bathroom. Everyone was terrified of the Spanish Inquisition. So screw having conversations. Let's torture people to confess and obey the church under fear of torture. So, some wanted this, some wanted that. So no wonder why they couldn't figure out a solution. Well, fortunately for them, in the midst of this discussion, in 1534, Pope Clement would die, and he would be succeeded by Pope Paul III. Pope Paul III. Pope Paul was a different type of pope. He saw the corruption of Alexander and Leo. He saw the problems that Clement got into. He saw what was spreading across the continent. He read the words of Luther. He saw how England just went up and bailed away during Henry VIII. He learned about the first round of religious wars. And Pope realized something. Pope Paul. Yeah, the church is to blame. The church is to blame. So how are we going to save the church? Well, he decided the best thing that he can do is to basically clean up the papacy. Why is the church as an institution corrupt? Well, because the person at the top, God's vicar on earth, had allowed it to occur. You know, at the end of the day, a little sign, Harry Truman, President Harry Truman had on his desk. Buck stops here. That's key. If you're going to be the CEO or the boss or the manager of a company, you are in charge. You set the tone. So all these people had been saying the corrupt was church. Well, all you had to do was open up a freaking history book. It was literally there in black and white. It was undeniable. So, the only way to save the church, therefore, is to fix the top. So the top can begin fixing the levels below. So what did he do? He went on the offensive. He didn't go after the Protestants. No, no, no. He went after the people in the church who didn't care about the corruption. Hey, whatever. It's always been like this. There's nothing we can do about it. Went after the corruption itself. Why the hell is the church selling little scraps of paper? Using little boxes to trick people to take their money. Why is it that bishops own brothels and bars You don't go in the clergy to become rich. No, the job of the clergy is to help people, to guide them, so they will go up and not down. But he knew he couldn't do it himself. So he brings in other like-minded people. He appoints a commission that begin gathering data from all across Europe, going back decades and decades and decades. They look at all the claims. They fact find. They gather evidence. And you know what they declare? Yep. 95 theses, Martin Luther, 100% right. So what do they suggest? You can't have the Catholic Church selling indulgences. You can't have the Catholic Church selling relics. You can't have the Catholic Church selling offices. The church should not be a for-profit business. So, the commission basically says, we're going to start naming names of the people who we know are corrupt and suggesting them for termination. Not death. They just lose their positions. They'd be demoted, banished to monasteries, stuff like that. Where does the Pope go first? Well, the rung right below, the cardinals. He would go through and literally purge the College of Cardinals. Any cardinal that bought their way into the position, any cardinal that's corrupt, gone. And he would replace them with scholars, intellectuals, believers devoted to the faith. And by the way, this would be significant because many of the cardinals that he would pope would eventually succeed him, which suddenly meant instead of having corrupt slime balls like the Alexander VI or the Leo X, you started having people more like Pope Paul III. Literally would change the direction of the church. He also realized he needed foot soldiers. He needed people on the ground in all of the countries to observe the bishops and the priests and the rectors of the monasteries. So he would create a secret society. Today, we refer to the Society of Jesus as the Jesuits. This order would be formed by Ignatius of Loyola. Ignatius was more of a military man than he was an intellectual. So in creating the Jesuits, he actually organized it like an army. Loyola would be the general, the Pope would be the commander-in-chief, and he had an officer hierarchy that made sure that the boots on the ground were devoted to the faith. And then they would fan out. And they would defend Catholicism on a global level. How would they do it? Well, they served as preachers, as teachers. Heck, Holy Cross, Jesuit school. They would serve as confessors, inquisitors, but they also served as spies. They would appear in all of the courts around Europe, and they would document the actions, particularly the Catholic states, to make sure none of them are going to embrace Protestantism. And if it was, it would be reported. And amazingly, people would end up dead. Assassinated. protect the faith. And ironically, if it wasn't for the Jesuits, France would have became a Protestant nation, as would Poland, as would many of the southern German states. The Jesuits also went with the Spanish. It was the Jesuits that made the Philippines into a Catholic country, which we briefly talked about. So, we acknowledge the problems, we start appointing worthy leadership, we have our foot soldiers. What if we meet resistance? Well, using Cardinal Jimenez's model, Pope Paul would recognize what technically was known as the Holy Office. What the Holy Office was the Roman Inquisition. So, if you would be accused of corruption, or if you would be accused of heresy, you would be brought before the Holy Office and you would be put on trial. So, we're going to basically fix the ship. We're not going to let it sink. We're going to stabilize things, and we're going to set it on the right course. Questions? How do you make it permanent? Well, he also called forward all of the cardinals from across the Catholic world, and they would gather in the city of Trent. And they would hold a council, which technically was in session for nearly 20 years, although they only met like 4 times. This Council of Trent would issue the new rules for the Catholic Church going forward. And by the way, the rules of the Council of Trent would remain the rules of the Catholic Church all the way until 1963, when there was another church-wide gathering known as Vatican II. At its core, this was to be the church's official response to Protestantism, theologically and ecclesiastically. So in terms of faith and in terms of operation. On one hand, what about all the corruption? Well, no more. The Council of Trent would declare that the best way to stop the abuses, the corruption, is through discipline. So if you're a priest and you're not doing your job, you're gone. If you're a cardinal, you're not doing your job, making sure everyone below you is following the rules of the church, you're gone. There would be no tolerance for laziness, for vice, for corruption. Why? Well, they would outlaw many of the things that Luther and others pointed out. No more false indulgences. No more buying offices. No more secular pursuits. It was the model of the Patriots. Well, they actually were a good football team. Do your job. The cardinals watch the bishops. The bishops watch the clergies. If there was a problem anywhere, the suspected would be held accountable. And any abuse would be corrupted. Well, what if you didn't like this? Too bad. If you are a Catholic, these are the rules you have to follow. Because the church was declared once again, to be the supreme vehicle that assures salvation. No, your faith alone is not going to get you there. You have to go to church when the church tells you to go to church. You have to do all of the things that the church tells you to do. So, good works. You must give at least 10% of your income to the church annually. You must attend Mass. You must go to Holy Days of Obligation. You must follow the procedure during Mass. You must live your life according to church law. All of the sacraments, all seven, are going to be sanctified. So you have to get baptized at birth. No deciding when you're going to get baptized. No, you must. You have to get First Communion. You have to go to confession. You must be married in the church. Marriage, till death do you part. All of the things, last rites, all of those things you must do. The saints are preserved. True indulgences are acknowledged, but to get an indulgence, you must confess. You are expected to go on privileges. At some point, you should go to Rome, attend Mass in the Vatican. Oh, and priest celibacy, the cult of the Virgin, those are still to be embraced. Now, once all of these rules were made and finalized, and by the way, it wouldn't be until 1463, after the death of Pope Paul III, well, the Council of Trent would send its findings and its report to the then Pope, Pius IV, who essentially anointed it, put his stamp of approval on it. And thus would formalize the Catholic Church. And if you don't like it, too bad. You want to be a Catholic? This is what you must do. If you don't, you're not a Catholic. And you're going to hell. So much for toleration. So much for Thomas More's idea of, hey, let's have a conversation. Let's sit down. Let's be friends. No. It was a conservative response. We acknowledge that they were right. We're going to fix the problems, but everything else stays. Well, guess what? Guess what would be the result of this? What happens when people no longer are willing to talk to one another? What happens? Conflict. Wars. Of course, the irony is by saving the church would entrench itself, and the lines in the sand would be drawn. If you do not follow our will, you are heretics, and you must be destroyed. Questions? All right. I'll give you a little bit of one that I have. And then we'll call it a class. What essentially would erupt is wars, battles that took place, in which the Protestants basically would stand their ground, the Catholics would stand their ground, and they would clash. Now, had they been paying attention right in the beginning, they would have seen the futility of this. Because lo and behold, in 1529, a war would erupt in Switzerland, quickly followed by another war in 1531. These are known as the Wars of Capel. What triggered the war? Zwingli. Zwingli wanted to reform the churches in Switzerland. But Switzerland was divided into tiny little, I guess we would call them like counties, although they were called cantons. Little separate, maybe more like states, like how Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New Hampshire is. So each one had their own government, and each one had within it their own church. Well, Zwingli began going around and basically trying to purify, in his vision, the churches and the cantons. Well, the problem is some of the northern cantons embraced this new reformation. But many of the southern cantons said, no, we want to stay Catholic. So what ended up happening? Military alliances were made. Tensions began to grow. Well, fortunately, even though war was declared in 1529, no battles were actually fought. No bloodshed occurred. Why? Well, much to the chagrin of Zwingli, the leaders of the Protestant, now Protestant cantons, met with the leaders of the Catholic cantons, and they negotiated a compromise. Very simple. The Catholics would keep the Catholic faith. The Protestants could do the Protestant faith. But no outside alliances. So for the southern cantons, this meant they had to break their alliance with Austria. Well, that was great. Except it still didn't fix the problem. Zwingli, instigator. He began firing up all the Protestants, and particularly by 1531, when there were more Protestant states than there were Catholic states. Zwingli basically told the Protestants, well, let's just go conquer them. There's more of us. And an actual war erupted. So in 1531, armies went on the battlefield. And thousands would die, including Zwingli. But in the end, both sides realized, okay, this is stupid. You're Swiss, I'm Swiss. You read the Bible, I read the Bible. You read the Bible the way you want to read it, I read the way I want to read it. Why the hell are we killing one another? So in the end, they made a peace agreement based upon this principle. And this will be the last click of the day. Cuius regeo, eos religio. Cuius regeo, eos religio. Whose rule? His religion. Whose rule? His religion. So, if you lived in a state where the government was Protestant, Protestantism is going to be the religion of that state. If you don't like it, you can move to a place that is Catholic. Because if you live in a Catholic state, that's going to be the religion of the state. One last point. Initially, the Swiss allowed the Catholics and the Protestants to move freely, without violence. But eventually they realized that was even stupid. So within a decade after the Second War of Cappel, the Swiss basically said, even if you're a Catholic and you're living in a Protestant canton, you can still be a Catholic. That's fine. Thousands died. And they figured it out. But you know the problem with history? Nobody knows history. They don't pay attention to it. They think it's boring. There's nothing to learn from it. And oh my God, it's only going to get worse. When we come back, we're going to see what would erupt in the Holy Roman Empire. Then we're going to see what erupted in France. Then we're going to see what almost happened in England. And then we're going to finish with the biggest, most violent of them all, the 30 Years' War. Look at that.